Hello and welcome to this Regulatory Transparency Project virtual event. My name is Jack Darwin and I'm Assistant Director of RTP at the Federalist Society. Today, we're pleased to host a discussion on stablecoins. To discuss this topic, we have a great three-person panel joining us. In the interest of time, we'll keep these intros brief, but you can visit regproject.org to view their full bios. Just a moment here, I'll turn things over to our moderator, who is John Burlaw. John is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where his work focuses on how public policy affects access to capital, entrepreneurship, and investments. He's also the author of George Washington, Entrepreneur, How Our Founding Fathers' Private Business Pursuits Changed America and the World. After opening statements and discussion between our panelists, we'll go to audience Q&A if time allows. To ask a question, you can either enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window or utilize the raise hand function to allow us to call on you to ask it verbally. And finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion on today's program are those of the speaker. Without further ado, John, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Jack, and thank all of you for joining. As Jack said, I am John Burlaw. I am senior fellow. I am also now director of finance policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute think tank. And I work on financial policy, fintech, barriers to entrepreneurship and to wealth building by investors. And I'm very happy to host this forum with these distinguished panelists on stablecoins, which are unique types of digital tokens, which have sort of emerged out of the cryptocurrency revolution. Originally were created just to trade within cryptocurrency, between cryptocurrency exchanges and among cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, but like the blockchain itself are just developing into their own with just numerous other uses aside from basic cryptocurrency trading. And these panelists, these distinguished panelists, are going to talk about this. We have Paul Jossi, who is a principal attorney at Jossi PLLC. And he is also an adjunct fellow at my organization, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where he writes about cryptocurrency and crowdfunding. He has practiced law for 6 years, representing clients in both state and federal court in Florida, Georgia, Virginia, and Washington, D.C., and his wide-ranging practice has included everything from simple contract disputes to First Amendment litigation. But Paul is Paul has specialized in campaign finance and election law for the past 3 years, but has also now expanded into business startup and capitalization, focusing on the crowdfunding provisions of Title III and regulation crowdfunding of the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act of 2012, whose regulations went live May 2016, and which the law itself just celebrated its 10th anniversary of a true bipartisan, mostly deregulatory achievement signed by President Obama and passed by the Republican House and the Democratic Senate. And in addition to managing his own firm, Paul is an adjunct here at CEI, as well as the Center for Competitive Politics, where he researches and writes commentary about campaign finance issues. And his work has appeared in the cryptocurrency publication CoinDesk, as well as the New York Post, The Hill, and The Federalist and National Review. And we are also pleased to have Tim Massett here, who is currently a research fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown Law School, and a consultant on financial, regulatory, and fintech issues. And Tim served under the Obama administration as chairman of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission from 2014 to 2017. Under his leadership, the agency implemented the Dodd-Frank reforms of the over-the-counter swaps market and harmonized many aspects of cross-border regulation, including...
John, I think we've lost you.
Yeah, I can't hear. I'm not getting the audio.
And he appears to be frozen.
Maybe put it in the chat.
Yeah, you got it?
Yeah.
No, okay. Jack, are you there?
Not sure what's going on there. Hopefully we can get John back here in a moment. If you don't mind, Tim, would you, can we turn it over to you for an
opening? Well, I think Paul was going to go first. So,
oh, great. My apologies.
Maybe, yeah. Jack, you could just ask the first question and I'll defer to Paul and then chime in.
Right. So I think the first question basically is sort of what are stablecoins and where do they fit into the crypto ecosystem, if you will. So I'll go ahead and start with that question. Actually, I'll start with something else that has a bigger implication for the issues that we're going to talk about today, and that it also involves stablecoins, which is the sort of the interrelation between government and innovation. So starting tomorrow, the crypto marketplace Celsius will no longer allow ordinary people to stake their crypto holdings with them and earn crypto rewards. So if a stablecoin were to say $100 worth of a stablecoin were to be staked with Celsius, an ordinary person would get about 9% APY on that stablecoin. Now, if you for comparison,
I am sorry about that.
No problem. We're just jumping into.
We're
the
already
first
off
question.
To the races,
yeah.
John.
We're jumping into we're the
already,
first question.
And you're answering the first question, Paul. You're going.
Yeah. And I need to update that bio. I was having flashbacks to 2012 there, but anyway. So if ordinarily, if someone was on Celsius staking that, they would get about 9% APY. Compare that to if they were to take that same $100 and put it into a savings account through the regulated banking system, their interest rate would be about 0.06. So accredited investors are still able to use this function in Celsius. But everyone else, about 87% of us are not now able to do that. And this is the same story. The federal government has shut down essentially or settled with BlockFi, a similar crypto marketplace. And the state of New York has done some similar things. So if you ask these crypto marketplaces why they did this, why they are disallowing these services, they would say, well, we had discussions with regulators. And if you ask the regulators, they would say, we shut these down in the interest of investor protection and protecting the public. But the only people who are really losing here are the people who now do not get to stake their cryptocurrency with these exchanges and get the extraordinary interest rate coming back to them of 9%. And instead, if they went into the regulated banking system, are going to get something like 0.06%. So I think this is an example of government interfering with markets in a way that purports to help them, but unfortunately, in the end, only harms people. So, what are stablecoins? Stablecoins are digital assets pegged to the value of a stable monetary value, usually the U.S. dollar. And if you go anywhere in the world right now where there is crisis, where there is extreme poverty, where there is people in desperate situations, you will find people trying to acquire stablecoins. So just some examples. When Russia invaded Ukraine a couple of months ago, the stablecoin Tether was actually in Ukraine, was trading at a premium of $1.10. That's never really supposed to happen. It's supposed to always be pegged to a dollar. But they had become so valuable in Ukraine that they were trading at a premium. In East Asia, in China and other countries in East Asia, chain analysis found that stablecoin Tether was more popular than Bitcoin itself. If you go, the very popular crypto columnist Nick Carter stated that he was astonished to learn that in Venezuela, people were using the service Local Bitcoin not to invest or buy or transact in Bitcoins, but as a backdoor way to acquire stablecoins. And Google Trends says that in Argentina, the search term MakerDAO, which makes the stablecoin DAI, is a more popular search term in Argentina than it is in the United States. And the examples go on and on. And so why is this? Why do people all over the world try to get their hands on these on stablecoins? And the CEO of Paxos recently had a testified before Congress in a and he sort of gave an example of this. Paxos is a blockchain company, and I thought it was really apt. So I'm just going to read a few sentences from what he said, talk about the future uses of stablecoins, and then turn it over to Tim. So the CEO of Paxos said, what people want is a U.S. bank account. Everywhere in the world, people want a U.S. bank account. And actually, that's the hardest thing to get. And crypto is a tool for a lot of different things, including bringing communities together. But what people want in order for their everyday spending, it's dollars. If you're in Argentina, you want dollars. If you're somebody anywhere in the world, you want to have access to dollars. And that's the hardest thing to get access to right now. And that's why tokenized dollars are so valuable, because you don't need to have a bank account. You can have access to the dollar-based system. It's a very, very important tool for inclusion. So that's the case with stablecoins now. But if we look into the future with
the... We need to talk about the future later. Let's go to Tim's opening statement.
Yeah.
And we can talk about it on the other panel. So thank you,
thanks,
Paul.
Thanks, John. Okay. And thanks, Paul. Look, let's put this in perspective. The use cases that Paul is talking about represent a very, very small fraction of the growth in stablecoins. Stablecoins have grown enormously from about $30 billion in market cap in the spring, let's say, of 2021 to about 100, or I'm sorry, 2020, to about $180 billion now. And that's primarily because they are very useful in buying and selling other cryptocurrencies. They allow you to make instant settlement, meaning when you buy Bitcoin, it settles instantly. It's not like a stock where it takes two to three days to settle and you have time to fund your account. You have to have your money there at the time. And if you try to do that with dollars through a bank wire or through some other way, that can be very slow. And, you know, on a decentralized blockchain, which is where a lot of the trading of cryptocurrencies occur, you can't do it at all through that means. You have to have a stablecoin. That is why they have grown. That is why they've powered the growth of DeFi. They have also grown because, quite frankly, people do use them for regulatory avoidance, for avoiding whether it's capital controls or other restrictions on what they're supposed to do with their money. Now, Paul may say we shouldn't have those restrictions anyway, but you know, that's the world we live in. People use them to avoid reporting taxes on capital gains on crypto. Now, I agree with Paul. They could have broader use, and I think we should explore that. But we have to recognize what they're used for today, number one. And secondly, the value of them is that they speed up payments. And we should recognize there are other ways to do that. Are stablecoins the best way? Well, you know, you can debate that. The main thing, though, to remember is there is no regulatory framework around them. And they do pose certain risks, which I'm sure we're going to get into.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, Tim, you would agree the payment system today is inefficient, and stablecoins are one tool that could help those inefficiencies.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the payment system, particularly in the U.S., is it's safe, it's reliable, but it is slower and it's more expensive than I think what we can achieve. It's slower and more expensive than what many Europeans and people in other countries have access to. It's, you know, or even in Asia, look at what's happened with firms like Alipay. And now the government in China is rolling out a central bank digital currency. So yes, I think we need to improve the payment system. Stablecoins are one possible way of doing that. But I know, John, you want to get into the risks, so I'll go back to you.
All right. Thank you so much. And I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about, you know, I was cut off before I finished. I finished your bio. So if there's anything else say from that. So anyway, I will start with you, Tim. What are your opinions of the President Biden's? I recently had a working group over the on stable coins, where they recently they had a lot on the risk. They did acknowledge there were benefits, didn't have that much, but basically came to the conclusion that it was not just insured deposit institutions such as banks, but very large banks that would only very large banks would be under comprehensive supervision that should be allowed to issue them. Tim, what are your opinions? And then we'll go to Paul.
Well, they didn't say only very large banks. They did say only insured depository institutions.
Only insured deposit insurance under comprehensive supervision wasn't.
Yeah, but that the report did not specify large banks. Now, I think we'll get to that in a moment.
Yes.
Look, I think the report was very good in highlighting the risks. I agree with you. It could have highlighted the benefits more. And I think the Biden administration is already kind of pivoting a bit to that with the executive order that came out on ensuring responsible innovation in digital assets. They've recently highlighted the need to improve the payment system and that stablecoins, you know, might be one way to do that. On the risks, they highlighted three types of risks. One is, to simplify it, a run risk. Stablecoins take in dollars, they issue tokens, they then invest those dollars. If there is suddenly a spike in demand for redemption of the stablecoins, the question is, will they have the liquidity, will they have the cash to honor those redemptions? That depends on their own investment policies, the safety of those investments, and their liquidity policies. In this respect, they are similar to money market funds. And, you know, we've had two runs on money market funds since 2008, where the federal government had to step in. So I think the PWG report was correct in saying that we need to address the run risk. You can do that by, you know, having requirements on how those reserves are invested and on liquidity policies. Number two, they said, look, there are payment system risks here. And this is actually an area that a lot of people don't focus on, including people in Congress who, you know, are now looking at new legislation on this. People have to understand, stablecoins are issued by an issuer and they're redeemed by an issuer. But the trading then takes place on blockchains. And those can be decentralized, quote unquote, decentralized blockchains, which are really just smart contracts that execute transactions. And frankly, they're not nearly as decentralized as people think, because there's typically very high concentration, both in the governance tokens and in the validators who book the transactions. Those blockchains can have issues. They can have software bugs. They can be hacked. They can simply be not kind of big enough, not resilient enough to handle the trading. They're not regulated in any way. So there's a payments system risk there too. There's also potentially a concentration risk. You know, if you only have one stable coin or they're not interoperable, what do you do then? It would be like, you know, imagine if we had phone companies or email services that weren't interoperable, things like that.
Tim,
so how do you regulate them? Let me just add a note. But here's where I thought the PWG report didn't quite get it right. They did say insured depository institutions only, subject to traditional supervision. I think that would lead to only big banks being able to do it just because of their advantages. And I do think that recommendation should have been broadened so that we have more of a special purpose bank, a narrow bank concept, where we tailor the regulation to what the stablecoin issuer is doing, assuming it's not making loans and it's not engaging in the other things that banks do. And in that case, you know, we wouldn't need to provide deposit insurance.
Okay, thank you so much. Paul, what are your thoughts on the PWG?
Well, I certainly agree with Tim that it focused on the risk. It was one of the impressive things was it actually put the word risk in this 26 page report 131 times, and some of those 26 pages weren't even actual text of the of the report. They were like cover pages and stuff. So that's an impressive thing in its own right. The one good thing that I would say about it is the fact that they actually asked Congress to do this, at least initially, and not try to do it sort of sua sponte on their own through the administrative state. Unfortunately, they did sort of say, well, if Congress doesn't do this, then we would recommend that the Federal Civility Oversight Council step in and sort of do it on its own and declare stablecoins a systemic risk to the entire financial system. If you look at the numbers, and I can get into the numbers if you want, I don't want to keep going on and on, but stablecoin industry is nowhere near a systemic risk. I'll just give sort of one example here. The Clearinghouse Payments Company clears 1.8 trillion payments per day. That's one of eight systemically important financial market utilities. All of stablecoins combined clear about 1 trillion per quarter year, so four times a year. So there's a sort of vast gap there of are these systemically risky compared to things that have been already designated systemically risky? And if there is one that happens to grow that much, then it should be evaluated on its own merits. And not sort of have this blanket designation for the whole industry.
Okay. Well, we are going to get into the mechanics of regulation with the talk about Senator Toomey, ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, has introduced the Stablecoin Trust Act, and part of the which includes disclosure of redemption policies for a stable coin, as well as disclosure of the reserves. There's a broad consensus that should be required, just as protecting consumers from fraud. But where there is debate is whether there should actually be reserve requirements for stable coins, similar, not quite the same, but similar to those, you know, capital requirements for banks, and even some are even proposing things like deposit insurance. Now, in the Stablecoin Trust Act, Senator Toomey's bill, he actually does have reserve requirements for one type of charter from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, but there are other things, the federal license designed specifically for payment stablecoin issuers, and state-based money transmitter or similar license under state law, where there are no reserve requirements, as far as my understanding. There are other things in the bill, like exemption from being regulated as a security, which is for all cryptocurrencies, kind of a big issue now with the SEC and whether it has jurisdiction and what federal law gives it jurisdiction to declare stable coins and cryptocurrency securities or a money market fund. So, Paul, let's start with you on what is your opinion of the Toomey bill and the issue of both disclosure and reserve requirements?
Yeah, thanks, John. I think that the Toomey bill comes pretty close to where we need to be at. I do not think there needs to be a specific level of reserve requirements that stablecoin should have. The most popular stablecoin in the world is Tether, and it's also the oldest, and it also has the most quote unquote riskiest assets with commercial paper, although they just stated yesterday that they're going to lower their commercial paper holdings. But what the regulation should be is auditing what you have, what are the different financial instruments you have in your reserve, and how people can redeem them. And other than that, it really should be up to the market to decide which ones are have the most peg integrity. And you can really leave that up to the exchanges in the virtual marketplaces, because that's their business, and they're going to know which ones are going to be the most, have the most integrity. And if there's not one, they're certainly going to drop it, because they're not going to take the risk on losing money. Now, if you have one that is an OCC chartered federal charter, that might be a different situation because of the federal charter requirements. But they should not, in my opinion, have to go through that process. They should be regulated under either, as Senator Toomey suggested, a new federal regulatory licensing type regime, or even state by state. Tim mentioned there's no regulatory framework right now. I'm not sure I agree with that. There are state by state money transmission laws. And so I think that the Toomey bill is pretty close to, a good solution to this that lets the market decide who are the best ones.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah. And I should mention, before we go to you, Tim, I should mention on the one of the reasons on the OCC bill is because that gives access to the master account. So it was kind of like if you access the Fed for dollars, you need to have those reserve requirements there. But for the other ones that don't give access to the Fed, they don't have the reserve requirements. And Tim, what are your thoughts on the stablecoin trust?
I think disclosure is a good thing. I like that part of the Toomey law, but I think we do need reserve requirements. In this respect, stablecoins are similar to money market funds. I don't think they should be regulated exactly like money market funds. I think Senator Toomey is on the right track with respect to the idea that the OCC should regulate issuers. I'll get to the state part in a minute. But we need reserve requirements for the same reason that, frankly, we need them with money market funds, although that still isn't enough. I mean, what we have with money market funds, right, was people said, oh, they'll be fine. Yeah, they're not insured. That'll be fine. We've had two runs on money market funds since 2008. Paul mentioned Tether was the oldest stable coin, hasn't had a problem. The Reserve Primary Fund was the oldest money market fund. It was venerated. It had $62 billion in assets. Less than 1% of its assets were in Lehman commercial paper. And there was a run on it the minute that Lehman filed for bankruptcy. That triggered a broader run on money market funds generally, which was only stopped by federal intervention. In 2020, we had the beginnings of another run on money market funds. Now, we're now looking at regulation of money market funds, and that's good. But the point is, you need reserve requirements for these things, at least until we have more experience with them, so that you ensure that the reserves are invested in high quality liquid assets. As to the state issue, there are regulations, but they weren't designed for stablecoins. They were designed for money transmitter businesses, and they're simply not sufficient. They vary from state to state. And that's where I do differ strongly with the Toomey legislation, in that, I think we do need a federal overlay of standards. He has provided that with the option of, a bank issuing these, or what he calls a national limited payment stablecoin issuer. And both of those could be subject to reserve requirements. The state option, similarly, could be licensed by the states, but then you need an overlay of federal standards that ensures reserve requirements, liquidity requirements. And again, I come back to this issue of how they're traded. We've got to address the fact that these are traded on these decentralized blockchains, which do pose additional risks.
Okay. I am going to I see we have some questions about whether they should be regulated like money market funds, and a couple good questions from Bert Ely, who is very distinguished on financial issues, financial policy. But we will come back to those in the question and answer. I want to get to my next question. Proponents of central bank digital currency have talked about the need for that for financial inclusion, also other reasons as far as competition for the dollar with China, which has a digital yuan. I'm wondering, and you each are free to give your opinion of central bank digital currency, although that is a topic, and I think Regulatory Transparency Project, I've participated in one, in fact, has had topics on CBDCs. But can stablecoins fulfill some of the functions can privately issued stablecoins fulfill some of the functions of both financial inclusion and making the dollar more competitive? And I'll go to you first, Tim.
Well, I think you got to focus first on what is the potential benefit to financial inclusion? Why do we even associate the two things? And the primary reason, in my mind, is that stablecoins could be a means to speed up the payment system, and that would be valuable. People who live paycheck to paycheck, even if they have a bank account, often face delays in getting their paycheck cashed. It might take 3 to 5 days. And if they need to pay their bills right away, they can't do that. So what do? They go to a check cashing service. They have to pay, you know, maybe 10% of the value of their check, but they get the cash with which they can pay their bills right away. Speeding up payments would be beneficial to them. Having them be able to have digital accounts that don't that aren't as costly, say, as bank accounts might be a good thing too. Stablecoins are potentially a way to address that, but there's other ways to address it too. And CBDCs also are a potential way to address that. CBDCs, I think we'd need another hour, John, to really get into all the pros and cons.
Well, feel free to say within the time frame what you think of those.
The short point on CBDCs is we're years away from having one, and we don't know exactly what it would look like. And that's what we really need to figure out is what would it look like? And then we can have the debate. People like me can debate, you know, all day long about the pros and cons of a CBDC. But until you really get the engineers in the room and figure out how would you do it, how would you avoid disintermediation of the banking system, how would you address privacy concerns, intrusion by the government, so on and so forth, you don't really know what it would look like. So maybe we stick with stablecoins today. But the point is, there are other ways to address financial inclusion. I just came out with a paper with Hal Jackson at the Harvard Law School talking about the fact that the Treasury could create, you know, accounts for people that could help address financial inclusion based on technology today. So I think, you know, stable coins are worth exploring in this regard, but there are also other ways we could tackle it.
Okay, thank you. And Paul, what are your thoughts on whether stable coins can achieve functions of financial inclusion and competitiveness with the dollar, and any thoughts you may have within the time frame on CBDCs themselves?
Right. Thanks, John. Well, you know, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, I don't think we need to wait to see the answer to this. It's already happening. People all over the world are using stablecoins right now. They don't need, they don't need sort of Big Brother telling them how to do it. They're doing it right now on their own, and they're figuring it out. And they want access to dollars because of its familiarity and because it's the strongest store of value as far as monetary in the world right now. And so that's why people want them. They hold their dollar, although I don't know how much longer they're going to hold their dollar hold their value, but the way that the Fed is going. But the financial inclusion part of it, I think, is already being solved right now. And just quickly on CBDCs, Tim mentioned we don't know what they're going to look like. And that's right for the most part. But we do know some broad outlines. One of them is that they will be through the bank. The Federal Reserve has already said that through private banks, they won't be direct accounts with the Fed. And that has consequences for financial inclusion. If you look at why the 5.4% of Americans don't have bank accounts, you can look at 20% don't have enough money to meet the requirements. 16% don't trust banks. 8% have credit problems. 7% complain about fees. 7% complain about privacy issues. None of that goes away with a CBDC. So especially one that's intermediated through a bank, it's going to come with fees. It's going to come with the trust problems. It's going to come with all of this other stuff. So I think the financial inclusion argument that proponents of CBDCs make is really a red herring.
Okay. Well, my last question, then we'll go to concluding remarks, is there is much discussion about how and whether to apply Know Your Customer, anti-money laundering, Bank Secrecy Act reporting to stable coins and to cryptocurrency in general. And I just wanted to point out, because I have been researching this for about 20 years, that the system is not perfect for banks and people. Banks of one banker and community banker in Tennessee told me that the requirements of the Bank Secrecy Act cost him in total more than all the requirements of the Dodd-Frank. There are things where reporting over the $10,000 threshold, which is was set in the 70s, never been adjusted for inflation, and then anything that could be perceived as a suspicious activity where, you know, the bank is in the position of the policeman leads to a lot of excess reporting, and it sort of inundates, you know, law enforcement in trying to find the needle in the haystack. Plus, there is concern on both the left and the right of whether people would be, you know, racially, religiously, or ideologically profiled, as far as there have been concerns around the Patriot, you know, when the Patriot Act came out and enhanced Know Your Customer and suspicious activity reports, that it may lead to profiling of religious and immigrant communities. And also now there is a concern on libertarians and among the right about debanking, and whether something will be used to punish bad beliefs as well as the bad acts that we all want to stop. So, Paul, I will let you go first as far as applying KYC and AML. How do we stop bad actors, and what in general may need to be reformed about KYC and AML?
Thanks, John. Well, I would say here we have, again, another real-world example that happened to our neighbors in the North, where people had their bank accounts frozen for simply donating to a cause that was completely legal. Some of those people have not had remuneration, still have not had remuneration yet. And, you know, even though the government, the Canadian government has come out and said that these people were doing things that were completely legal. So I think that in general, AML, CFT regulations are ripe for abuse. And I think that it is a bit overblown, this sort of notion that people will use crypto specifically, and maybe more, or crypto in general, maybe more specifically, stable coins for rampant illegal use. The numbers, at least a chain analysis report came out, that these numbers are declining and have declined ever since the Silk Road crackdown in 2014. There are these rug pulls, there are these hacks. These are bad situations that need to get solved. The traceability of blockchains makes it a little bit easier for authorities to find these bad actors. There was a very high profile case in New York City with a couple that was recently arrested. There was even the famous VDAO hack of Ethereum from 2016. That person has allegedly been unmasked. So I think that to say that criminals are going to prefer something that for the most part is much more transparent and traceable than the anonymity of cash is a bit of a misnomer. And I think that the Canadian government declaring their own citizens, peaceful protesters, terrorists, essentially was a shameful act on their part, and it shows the abuse of these laws potentially.
Okay, thank you, Tim. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, sure. I would agree that our KYC and AML procedures can be improved, that there probably are practices that, you know, are a bit outmoded, and particularly given the advances in fintech and big data, we could make those more efficient. But that's not an argument for saying, well, let's not even apply it at all to this whole new sector. The fact is, we need reasonable KYC and AML policies and prevention of illicit activity. The estimates by chain analysis of the percentage of illicit activity is only an estimate, number one. They're not really going down significantly. And what's more important is the fact that the DeFi world is growing. And if the and we'll see if we can, you know, prevent activity there as easily. The problem also is the traceability on the blockchain is very valuable to law enforcement. No question about that. I agree with Paul. Easier to trace a crypto transaction on the blockchain than it is to trace a suitcase full of cash. But that's still after the fact, right? That's going after people after the fact, after a crime has been committed, unless you're saying, oh, let's have the government just, you know, watch the blockchain all the time and know who's on it and, you know, kind of look at everybody's transactions and get validators to stop them before they happen. That's not what we want either. We need reasonable procedures. Today, what we have is the centralized crypto exchanges have stepped up, have implemented procedures. I think that's gotten better in terms of doing KYC, but we don't have that in the DeFi world today, and we're going to need it. So, you know, I think there's got to be a reasonable medium. The other thing to remember about this, it isn't just about illicit behavior. It's about failure to report taxes. As the crypto universe grows, if you don't have these procedures, number one, it's going to be easier to use crypto for more and more things. So you're not going to have to convert through a bank or through some other entity that is going to impose KYC. And number two, even if you're going through that entity, if we don't have some way of tracking your capital gains and making sure you pay your taxes, we're going to see, you know, tax revenue fall. So we got to come up with reasonable procedures. The fact that this is an exciting new industry isn't a justification for saying, oh yeah, let's not monitor it. Let's not worry about it.
Okay. Well, let's thank you both and let's give some concluding remarks. Tim, would you like to go?
Yeah, sure. Look, I think I'm in total agreement with the fact that the payment system has flaws, needs to be improved, needs to be more efficient and speedier, especially in the US. But, you know, let's not overblow that case either. It is pretty good. It's pretty safe. People trust it. Generally hasn't created financial stability risks. And we have pretty good checks on illicit behavior. They may be inefficient. We could probably make them a lot more efficient. And we have dollar prominence in the world. So we need to improve payments, and stable coins could be one way to do that, but we need to have a good regulatory framework, a framework that protects against run risk, protects against payment system failures, and makes sure that we, you know, prevent illicit behavior and ensure tax reporting to the extent that we can. Let's also remember that, you know, when all this activity is promoted and is hyped, it's not quite as good sometimes as crypto enthusiasts make it out to be. Even, for example, the notion of DeFi, right? You look at the concentration of validators and miners. There's a recent report done on this. 50 validators control over 50% of the staking capacity, which determines whose transactions get booked and, you know, creates the risk that you could even, you know, have some malfeasance. 50 validators control 50% on all the top DeFi chains. So whether it's Solana, Cardano, et cetera. Same is true in Bitcoin. The cost on Ethereum, for example, $20 billion in fees across 460 million transactions. Just compare that to Visa. Visa was $24 billion in fees across 165 billion transactions. So Ethereum transaction costs 100 times what Visa transactions cost. So, you know, I think this is an exciting industry. It has promise, but let's not exaggerate its benefits today, nor should we minimize the risks that it poses. And let's create a reasonable regulatory framework around it.
Okay. Paul, do you have any concluding remarks?
Sure. Let me just address a couple of things here. You know, Tim is obviously a very learned scholar on these things, and I really appreciate his insight on this. This Visa Bitcoin comparison comes up a lot, especially when you in the energy debate around cryptocurrencies. One of the things that's missing, I think, from that debate from the perspective of people who make this comparison is the fact that, Bitcoin is a final settlement layer. And so when you do a Visa transaction, that is not it. It There is a 90-day window. This is backed up also by the entire federal government, including the U.S. military. So in total, you can look at, well, there's one fee for Bitcoin, or there's one fee for Ethereum, and then there's one fee for Visa. I don't think that's an apt direct comparison. I do agree, we don't have time to get into proof of work and proof of stake here, but I do agree that there are sort of very concerning things about proof of stake, potentially with lots of very rich people coming in and controlling governance. But it's really interesting. There's a book just written about the 2017 Bitcoin debate about whether they should increase the transaction size. And at one point, all of the corporate power, all of the mining power, all of the power was on one side to actually increase that. And then on the other side, you had the nodes and the validators, and the little guys won. And so that's something that just, it really does not happen very often. And that's something that we need to protect. So I think that, this hopefully this new iteration coming of Web3, where it's individually centered and the power and the data stay at the individual level, can remain there. And so people are not, for instance, content creators are not giving most of their take or a big chunk of their take to these massive platforms like YouTube. All of this will be fueled by stablecoins. And so in a perfect world, the government would be encouraging this and not trying to sort of stifle the innovation. I do agree with Tim that there should be some guardrails as far as disclosure and redemption policies. But other than that, we should just let the people who are actually creating this stuff do their work.
Okay. Before we get to question and answers, thank you both. Tim, did you want to quickly respond to what Paul said about the Visa and Bitcoin coins?
Yeah, I do want to respond to one issue. So I was just talking about the fees, and there's different ways you can compare stablecoins or crypto to our current payments. Paul was noting the finality of a Bitcoin transaction, and that's true. It's true for all crypto. A lot of people see that as a big advantage. I'm not so sure. I mean, it would mean, for example, if you order something from a merchant and the merchant, doesn't send it, you've already sent the money, you can't get it back. If there's a problem with the goods, you can't get the money back. There's a certain advantage to reversibility of transactions that we have today. So, people talk a lot about how stablecoins and crypto would be so wonderful as payment instruments. I mean, the fact is Bitcoin is not a payment tool, right? It's just a speculative investment. But even with stablecoins, I'm not so sure that everyone's going to say, oh yeah, I really want to be able to send my money to the merchant and not have any recourse if, they don't send me what I was expecting or the product turns out to be defective. So, just one point to keep in mind.
Right. There would be common law resource.
Meaning you're going to sue. That right. Means you're going to sue. Yeah.
Yes.
You're not going to be able to call up Visa and say, I didn't get this or it wasn't right. And have Visa say, oh, you're right. We'll credit your account. You're not going to have American Express insurance on, Right. I mean, granted, those things cost something, right? We're all right. Paying for those things, but you got to look at the whole picture. It's, the crypto enthusiasts often kind of just want to present certain aspects of the situation, the benefits, without kind of giving you the full picture.
Do we, Paul, have any, and I'll get to the question, I know that, Paul, do we have any evidence that stable coins are starting their own policies as far as refunds or things like that, or either of you, do we,
no.
it's something
you might see. You can't. John, right. You got to understand the technology. Once the transaction is booked on the blockchain, it can't get reversed unless you go to those 50 miners who control, more than 50% and say, let's reverse right. it. It doesn't happen.
Right. Well, it's
I would just say sort of the market has, again, the market has sort of spoken on this. There are billions of dollars that are settled on Bitcoin. And Nick Carter makes the comparison with, you cannot compare this to Visa. What you can compare it to is like Fedwire or something like this, where there are massive amounts of money being settled at one time. And if you add in Lightning, you add in sort of sidechain and third party applications on top of and on the side of Bitcoin, you will see that one settlement can actually settle potentially billions of dollars in a single transaction.
Yeah, but I mean, most of us don't use Fedwire to buy our goods or get our groceries delivered. And also on this point about, they're being widely used in these countries faced with strife. I mean, again, it's pretty small. I had a conversation recently with the former central bank governor of Afghanistan. And I was asking him, could a dollar-backed stablecoin be helpful? And he said, look, it sounds great in theory. It's not going to enable people in Afghanistan to get food. It's not going to enable them to get, gasoline or other, or coal or whatever they're using to heat their home. So let's be realistic about the use cases here. This is an early industry. It's used predominantly to settle crypto transactions. That's what's powered the growth of these DeFi blockchains. It potentially has broader use, but there are a lot of issues to work through and a need for a regulatory framework.
There are some fascinating technological issues. I want to get to Bert Ely's questions should they be regulated why shouldn't they be regulated as money market funds? And also,
sure. Why don't I take that one and then Paul can take the second one. So okay, Bert, right. Good to hear from you. It's always good to hear from Bert. So the reason I don't think they should be regulated as money market funds is they're not investment vehicles. They are payment tools. And that's, of course, assuming a stablecoin isn't paying interest or any kind of return, which is what the big ones are doing. So I'd rather see them regulated as payment instruments, and I'd rather bring them in under a form of banking regulation. Again, I'm willing to look at, it doesn't have to be the full panoply of bank regulation. We can have kind of a special purpose entity where the regulations are targeted. But I think you need reserve requirements, liquidity requirements, you need other forms of oversight. And I think, the banking regulators are better positioned to do that than the SEC.
Okay. Paul, did you want to answer the question about contagion? And I see we have a question from Brooke Blackman about Wyoming's cryptocurrency specific legislation. We'll get to afterwards.
Sure. Well, Tim and I definitely have a mind meld of keeping the SEC out of this. what I would say is, if you look at what's already happening right now, all of these big ones are already disclosing what their, what their reserves are. A lot of them are being audited by, reputable third-party accounting services. Anyone can go to see what they have backing their stablecoin. And some of the big ones have already, I think Circle has already applied for, maybe they've already got an OCC charter, I'm not sure. But as long as you can look and see what they have in reserve, that should take care of it. And again, I would go to the virtual marketplaces and the exchanges that are running this. They have a business risk to not allow something that is going to run and cost them money. So if there's a question about peg integrity, they are going to be the first ones to sort of step up and remedy that problem from a market standpoint.
Right. And let me just add, I'm in full support of disclosure, but on the break the buck point, just to address that directly, our money market fund has. Our money market fund regulation hasn't prevented, runs on money markets, right? When they have broken the buck. So, that's why I don't see that regime as being the right regime. I think a banking regime is better.
Okay. Now we're talking, we're actually, our next question is about Wyoming is setting up a specific tailored regulatory regime for cryptocurrency. I know they're doing a lot for their trying to customize their LLC laws for decentralized autonomous organizations or DAOs, which is a topic of another thing. But from what you both know of Wyoming's cryptocurrency legislation that Brooke Blackman asks about, would that be a model uniform code or provide a sufficient framework if no federal framework is implemented anytime soon?
Well, I would just say that I actually have a stablecoin paper coming out for CEI here, hopefully in the next month. And one of the options that sort of I offer is if a stablecoin issuer wants to have a state charter, they should be able to do that and have that as one of the options, but neither a state charter or a federal charter should be a requirement. And you're right, Wyoming has positioned themselves as one of the leaders there. And so if it wants to be the Delaware of, stablecoin issuers, I don't have a problem with that. And if that one, if stablecoin issuers want to do that instead of say a federal, money transmission law or go state by state, they should be able to do that.
Yeah. Thanks. And I would just say, I think Wyoming has, done a lot of interesting work in this area of developing, kind of a uniform commercial code issues with respect to crypto, developing special purpose depository institutions that, wouldn't lend. I think all that's very interesting, deserves attention. I don't think it eliminates the need for a federal oversight here. I would still like to see that. Now, you could maybe look at that in terms of size of issuer, perhaps, but I think we need consistency of this. These are going to be the ones that are really going to be prominent are going to be big. And yeah, they may not be systemically important today, but, they could grow. So I think we still need federal oversight, some uniform federal standards, so that we don't go down a path of inconsistency and regulatory arbitrage.
Okay. Are there any other questions? I think we have a couple minutes. If there would be one more question, if somebody wants to, either zoom in with a question or ask one in the chat box. Are there any other questions? I'll give that 30 seconds. All right. Jack or Jenny, do you see any other questions?
We do have a hand raised. I think it's Bert again. I'll give him permission to speak. I'm not sure if you already addressed it. I'll give him permission and see.
Yes. Bert?
Yeah, thank you. One of the things that's interesting about stable coins is how popular they are in a very low interest rate environment. What happens when interest rates begin to rise to more normal levels or even very high levels? Doesn't that increase pressure on the stable coin issuers to begin to pay interest on their stable coins, which they could do by just accreting the value on an hourly or daily basis? And if they start to pay interest in order to hang on to their balances, doesn't that bring them under the Securities and Exchange Act?
Excellent question, Bert. I agree with you that as interest rates rise, it'll be interesting to see what happens, whether people still use them as much or whether, one issuer obviously may come out with an interest-bearing one. I think that would give the SEC more grounds to say this is a security. That's going to be the stablecoin issuer is going to have to think about that, whether it wants to go down that road. If they don't pay interest and we're in a high interest rate environment, boy, these guys could make a lot of money, obviously. It's a challenge for us. I still would rather create a framework for federal regulation that is focused first on, a bank type regulation of stable coins that don't pay interest. And then maybe say, if they do pay interest, they are regulated by the SEC and, go down that path as well.
Paul, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would just say, the difference between the value of a stable coin pegged a dollar pegged stable coin and a dollar right now is a vast chasm. As I mentioned in the opening, my opening remarks, that you're talking about the difference between maybe 9% APY and 0.06%. So I think that if you just allow these marketplace, you keep the federal government sort of at bay, and you allow these virtual marketplaces to work, they will pay interest, and this problem will be solved on its own.
Okay. Do we have time for one more question? Because I see there is one. Jack, do we have time?
By all means.
Okay. From Michael Huber, the question is what the Biden administration would do after the study period. I assume the questioner is referring to this questions for study that were in the executive order. And that's also asking, do you foresee any type of crackdown? Paul, do you want to go and take that?
Well, I would say the crackdown started when Gary Gensler was appointed to the Securities and Exchange Commission. Has proceeded, ever since then. Maybe there will be a higher intensity of it, although I'm not sure that's possible. I don't see any leeway until there's a political change.
Okay. Tim, what are your thoughts?
Well, I guess I would approach it a little bit differently. I would say this is an industry that hasn't paid a whole lot of attention to the laws as they exist. And the SEC is reminding them of that fact. I think, the Biden administration, I think it's good that it's focusing on this across the government. It's good that they're doing these studies. My own view is we do need to strengthen crypto regulation. I've written about that, talked about that. I'm hopeful that what the Biden administration is focused on now will lead to that, not just for stablecoins, but for the rest of crypto. But, it should be done in a way that still encourages innovation. That's quite possible. And, I didn't get a chance to rebut Paul's opening on the relationship between regulation and innovation. But let's not forget, our securities markets have become the best and the strongest and the biggest and the deepest in the world under all these laws that Paul may not like, but when we started regulating them in the 30s, that was the beginning of a foundation which has led to their growth and dominance in the world. It's kind of similar with American banking. So, let's keep this regulation and innovation relationship. Let's maybe bring a more accurate perspective to it.
Right. But I mean, regulation can also exceed that. I mean, that's part of what led to the bipartisan agreement for the Jobs Act with the overkill from Sarbanes.
Which I thought was great. I think crowdfunding is great.
Cool.
And,
Right. Well, we had some good, we would say I think a great conversation, some points of common ground and some spirited disagreements without being disagreeable. So I thank Paul, I thank Tim and all of you for attending, and Jack and Jenny for setting this up. And thank you again, and look forward to doing this again as a panelist and moderator and having and discussing these issues with Paul and Tim and all of you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yep.
Thank you all so much. That was a fantastic discussion. And thank you to our audience for tuning in to today's event. You can check out our website at regproject.org or throw us a follow on any of the major social media platforms at FedStockRTP to stay up to date. With that, we are adjourned.